This is The Guardian.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Looking for your next great podcast? We live in unprecedented times. To make sense of it, what if you could learn from some of the most influential people on the planet? The podcast Tools and Weapons is hosted by Microsoft's Vice Chair and President Brad Smith. Every week, he has a candid conversation with guests, including prime ministers and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists. The latest episode features Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though most of us know Bayer for pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science. They're putting digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre. Listen to Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith, wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's rulings make very clear that the European states have a legal responsibility to take real climate action and to protect people and to protect its citizens.
This week, the European Court of Human Rights made a landmark ruling.
The key aspect of the case hinged on the fact, which scientists have well established, that older women are more likely to die in heat waves, and so they're disproportionately hit by weak climate policy.
The case was brought by a group of older Swiss women who claimed that Switzerland wasn't doing enough to cut emissions, putting their lives at risk.
Switzerland, like every country in the world, is a signatory of the Paris Agreement on climate change. They made promise after promise to try and limit the planet from heating 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial temperatures by the end of the century. That 1.5 degrees C target is the key indicator of when global heating really hits very, very dangerous levels.
The court found that Switzerland's climate policies had violated the plaintiff's fundamental human rights, opening up a path for future cases.
If any activist group want to put more pressure on their governments to honour their promises to keep the planet from heating 1.5 degrees Celsius, they can effectively just follow what the Swiss senior citizens have done.
So today, we're hearing more about how this case came about, what it could mean for activists and governments around the world, and what happens next. I'm The Guardian's science editor, Ian Sample, and this is Science Weekly. Ajit Naranjan, you're The Guardian's Europe environment correspondent. And before we dig into this landmark climate case from the European Court of Human Rights, I'd love to know more about the backstory. You've actually spent time with some of these women involved, and you went on a hike with them. Tell me about that.
Yeah. Last summer, I had quite a fun experience hiking in the Swiss Alps in Gürtchener See, one of the most beautiful spots in Europe, I guess you could say, with maybe, I think, 7 or 8 women involved in this court case. So they were all in the 70s. It was a very eye-opening experience hiking up a mountain with women more than twice your age who were just way more physically fit than I was. And they'd kind of chosen the spot partly because it showed what's at stake with climate change. So Swiss mountains, the nature, glaciers that are melting, and also there was a hydropower dam. The one thing that they hadn't planned out for that day was that there was a heat wave. So yeah, despite the hot weather and the strain of the hike on my unprepared legs, going on that hike was an incredible chance to actually get to know the people behind this lawsuit.
Tell me, how did this group and this case come about?
In 2015, Europe had seen one of the most powerful climate cases, which was in the Netherlands, the Urgenda case, where activists had taken the Dutch government to court about weak climate policy and got a court to rule, well, yeah, okay, you need to do a better job. And so there was suddenly this kind of precedent that meant that this flurry of court cases started coming through about climate change. And so what some lawyers initially from Greenpeace were discussing was, how can we get a group of people who are disproportionately affected by climate change to kind of take a group case against Switzerland's weak climate policy? And the group that they found were these Swiss women who'd retired. Older people are more likely to die from heat waves, and heat waves are getting hotter from climate change. But not only that, older women are at particularly high risk. And they went to the Swiss courts and said, hey, look, we are being hurt unfairly because of climate change, and that's not okay. The Swiss government needs to do better at cutting its emissions. And the Swiss courts chucked them out. But then this breakthrough came when the European Court of Human Rights said that not only would they look at the case, they would fast track it to the Grand Chamber, this kind of top bench of the court, and look at it alongside a couple of other big climate cases, with the idea that the European Court of Human Rights has never ruled on a climate case before. And so this panel of 17 judges needed to form kind of a cohesive opinion that would then be able to set the direction of how much courts could actually address, which kind of cases were admissible, the actual merits of how much are people getting hurt by climate change, how much are governments doing to stop it.
So Ajay, as you said, you've spoken to some of these women, and what was really motivating them individually to join this group, Klimasenioren?
I think what these women kind of said was, well, okay, we're in Switzerland. We're one of the richest countries on the planet. The Swiss have also produced per person much more planet heating gas than most other countries have. So they felt both this level of responsibility, but also recognized that they're not powerless. Some of them have been environmental activists for decades. Others have worked corporate jobs, or I don't know, anything from nurses to architects. But what was interesting when I went on the hike was that one of them said to me, one of Pia Hollenstein, who's on the board of the group, she said that she wasn't doing this to protect herself or the women of her age. She was doing it for my generation and people across the world, where the extreme weather events that are growing more violent have hit levels that are far beyond what we're seeing in Europe right now. And so there was this definite sense of, we can do something and we kind of have to do something, because this is the problem that is of a scale that, I mean, like, even courts are now admitting is to some degree existential.
What did the ruling say?
So they took it to the European Court of Human Rights, and the court first did one kind of landmark thing, which was they admitted the case. They said, yep, you as an organization formed of members all affected in the same way, you are allowed to take a case to the European Court of Human Rights and we'll take a look at it. That was new. On top of that, they also found that the Swiss women's right to privacy and family life had been violated by the Swiss government's failure to do enough on climate change. This is kind of quite a broadly interpreted human right, which encompasses a lot of things, including the right to kind of good well-being, living a healthy life. So it doesn't quite go as far as saying that their right to life has been endangered. That's a different article, which the court decided not to rule on. But on this Article 8, the right to privacy and family life, they found, yeah, the Swiss government's failure to enact good enough climate policy. They use the words act in good time. I think those four words are really significant. That kind of shows that you can't just be setting targets and making wishy-washy promises. You need to actually show a good plan that lines up with the science to do a fair share of keeping warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. And then you need to actually put in place the policies quickly to get there. And the court kind of ruled that you can't really use this argument of saying, well, we're just a drop in the ocean. They made the point that by committing under the Paris Agreement, every country has almost kind of agreed, like, hey, look, we're going to do our fair share to get there. And the minute that any country starts saying, well, it's not really up to us, let the others go ahead and do it, they're also weakening the likelihood that other countries will do that. So this kind of solidarity aspect on the kind of government level, super important.
Now we have that sort of favorable ruling from the European Court of Human Rights. What are the outcomes of that case? Does the Swiss government have to do anything? Do these women get any kind of sort of compensation?
So they didn't ask for any personal compensation. The court didn't list out kind of a plan for what the Swiss government has to do, but it made it very clear how it would interpret what governments across Europe now do to tackle climate change. So it's kind of on the Swiss government now to work out how to respond to this. The Justice Ministry, which was representing Switzerland, I think hasn't yet commented. They're going to have to review the verdict, which is hundreds of pages long, and work out exactly what the court's telling them to do. What's perhaps interesting is that Switzerland is a country where they have lots of referendums on everything. And it's maybe a good example of where these two aspects of lawmaking come into tension, because the Swiss in a referendum previously had said, yeah, okay, we're behind the kind of 1.5 degree target and cutting emissions quickly, but they rejected some of the policies to get there in a different referendum. And so now the government's probably got this bit of a dilemma, which is, how do you balance what people have said they want in referendums, which can be contradictory, with the laws that they're obliged to act within? In terms of activist pressure, it's very clear cut. If you can say that the government's violating human rights, that's a much stronger statement than saying the government's just not cutting emissions fast enough. So I think it's likely that this will increase the pressure on the government to enact better climate policy or more ambitious climate policy.
Were you in court for the judgment? And if you were, I'm wondering if you managed to speak to any of these women afterwards and what their reaction was.
Yeah, so the atmosphere in Strasbourg, where the European Court of Human Rights is, was, I would say, it was maybe one of understated enthusiasm. Like, the verdict was delivered alongside two others. So you had these young Portuguese, well, children and young people who'd taken 32 European countries to court for similar thing, the damage that wildfires and heat waves are doing, which disproportionately hit young people. And there was also a former French mayor who'd taken France to court for weak climate policy as well. And so these three cases were kind of being heard together, and nobody really knew what the outcomes would be. I think the lawyers I was speaking to the day before thought, okay, well, it's fairly likely that the French and Portuguese cases might not even be admitted. Their case was kicked out. The French case was also kicked out, both on procedural grounds rather than on the merits of the case themselves. There was this overarching feeling that these cases aren't individual matters. So if a win for any of them was going to be a win for the others. So there was this kind of almost slightly deflated, but also somewhat optimistic feeling at the end as kind of these Swiss women walked out of the court.
I am so, well, shocked, positively shocked, so happy, because we could do something. We could do something. We could contribute to the future, to a better future for our children.
And they were met by young people whose case hadn't been accepted, but who were thanking them. I mean, Greta Thunberg met Rosemary Vidlavelty, one of the Swiss climate seniors who I went on the hike with last year. I saw them meet outside the lobby of the court, and it was quite a touching moment. I mean, Thunberg thanked Rosemary Vidlavelty for everything she'd done for them.
And this is only the beginning of climate litigation. All over the world, more and more people are taking their government to court, holding them responsible for their actions.
So do you think there could now be more cases that come to the courts that look to name and shame governments and countries on their climate efforts?
So there's 46 members of the Council of Europe who are kind of, to varying degrees, I guess, kind of going to be panicking right now, because no country in Europe is really on track for the 1.5 degree C target. This now sets the precedent, right? Like, now that the European Court of Human Rights has ruled that weak climate policy can be a violation of fundamental rights, and that organizations can take governments to court, and that these cases can be admitted, it's almost like it's laid out a blueprint. The ripple effects of this will also be heard kind of across the globe. I think there's three different international courts, including the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, that this year are kind of giving out opinions on the role of governments in stopping climate change. And they will be looking to the European Court of Human Rights to some degree to see what they should say, how it fits into international law. The lawyers I spoke to obviously were very quick to emphasize how important court cases are as a tool to get governments to comply with the law effectively, right, on climate change. But this is just one lever of many.
Well, it's really complex stuff, obviously, but Ajit, a win is a win, right? So thanks so much for coming on and taking us through it. And I hope you get to go hiking with them again.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm very excited to get to see these Alps again. If I can hack it, that is a real question. Luckily, they certainly can.
My thanks again to Ajit Naranjan. If you want to follow more of his reporting, head to theguardian.com. While you're there, you should definitely take a look at a new competition The Guardian has launched, Invertebrate of the Year. Across the planet, the sixth great extinction is underway. And here in Britain, conservation scientists have estimated that one in six species are at risk of being lost altogether. Which is why we wanted to showcase the underappreciated and the often unloved wild world of invertebrates. Guardian environment journalists have chosen a shortlist of 10 species, and each nominee tells a story of a remarkable way of life and a way of surviving in the Anthropocene. Take a look at the nominees so far, nominate your own favourite invertebrate, and place your vote on theguardian.com. And before you go, I just wanted to let you know that today you can also hear our bonus episode looking back on the life and incredible science of physics great Peter Higgs, whose death was announced this week. This episode was produced by Madeline Finley. It was sound designed by Tony Onochuku, and the executive producer is Ellie Bury. We'll be back on Tuesday. See you then.
This is The Guardian.
Looking for your next great podcast? We live in unprecedented times. To make sense of it, what if you could learn from some of the most influential people on the planet? The podcast Tools and Weapons is hosted by Microsoft's Vice Chair and President Brad Smith. Every week, he has a candid conversation with guests, including prime ministers and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalists. The latest episode features Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though most of us know Bayer for pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science. They're putting digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre. Listen to Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith, wherever you get your podcasts.